One thing we need to make clear before we get started here is I am planning to give you pretty strictly the historical perspective, and you individual classes will then have to decide how that historical perspective fits into what you're reading. A lot of what we're learning about in Daniel is visions and dreams and prophecies. Now, there is some strictly narrative portions to Daniel, and so the historical perspective can give you kind of an idea of where Daniel's story fits into the larger story. But when we get to the dreams and the visions, the prophecies, I admit that I don't understand all of that. And I think there is some danger when you're talking about prophecy in trying to figure out exactly what it's going to look like. And the reason I think that is because the Bible had prophesied Jesus coming a long time ago. The Pharisees and the religious people of the day knew all those prophecies, and they knew them well, and they had decided what the Messiah would look like. And when he came, they missed him. And so because of that, I think there is danger in trying to, you know, decide this is the prophecy and this is exactly what it's going to look like when it's fulfilled. So I want to leave some ambiguity there. So what I'm giving you is just a tool in how to understand some portions of the book of Daniel. I admit that I doubt you'll understand all of them. I certainly don't. And it's not clear to me that all of the prophecies and visions have been fulfilled already. Some of them I think have. And we can see it pretty clearly when we know the narrative of history. Oh, it makes sense what Daniel was being told was going to happen when, you know, the king of Greece comes roaring against the king of Media and Persia with one horn, and his horn is broken off later and grew up into... That kind of thing makes sense once you understand the bigger history of it. So, oh, one more thing. Anytime you wish to interrupt me, I would enjoy that. I like when people interrupt me because it tells me that they're listening and interested in what I'm saying. So please do not feel bad about interrupting me with clarifications or your own input, as there are many of you out there, I'm quite aware, that know this stuff quite well and can help add some color to it. Okay, Aaron, you can get the first map up there. We're going to have a series of maps show up over here. And I kind of need that to give you some of the placement of these things. So I like to anchor history pretty firmly in a geographical location. And Karen, were you able to get copies made? Okay, great. The ushers are going to hand out some timelines. These are just basic timelines, but they give you an idea of when this stuff took place in relation to each other. So I'll refer somewhat to those timelines occasionally and kind of help see where we're at. Aaron, is there a problem? I pushed it once. Maybe I should push it again. Does it need to be turned on first? It was on, but I just unmuted it and nothing happened. Okay, it just must have died through neglect. Okay, well, to give you the setting of Daniel, you have to understand this is Daniel's captivity takes place in what we call the New Babylonian Empire. And the reason we call it new is because long, long time ago, back when Abraham was alive, or just a little before Abraham, there was an empire centered on the town of Babylon. And this was in ancient Sumer. This empire reached its peak during the time of Hammurabi, which many of you are familiar with as giving a code of law. Well, Assyria became powerful after that. And for many years, Assyria was the ruling power over much of this area, including Babylon down here. But, and Assyria also was instrumental in capturing the kingdom of Israel, not the kingdom of Judah, but the kingdom of Israel, and carrying them off and dispersing their inhabitants. And this was a really common practice in the empires of the day. They would just move into an area, conquer them, sweep up many of the inhabitants, and relocate them in a way to break up the nationality of them. So Assyria had been powerful, but just a little before the time of Daniel, kind of a coalition of tribes and groups of people. Babylon, the Babylonians were one. People over here in Persia and Media were other peoples in there. The Scythians up around the Black Sea, those were different people groups that allied together and said, we're tired of Assyria, and they kicked them out. They went and defeated the Assyrians, conquered Nineveh, and the seat of power then in the ancient world sort of settled around Babylon. And Babylon gradually became more powerful. And it reached its apex of power under King Nebuchadnezzar the second or third, I don't remember which. But it's the Nebuchadnezzar that we read of in the Bible is when the Neo-Babylonian Empire reached its peak, basically. Nebuchadnezzar was a really powerful military figure, and he subjected much of this region, came under Babylonian rule during his time, including Jerusalem. And that's where we read of in Daniel when Jerusalem fell, he did just what the empires had always done, collected large numbers of the inhabitants and moved them off to other places in the empire. And he especially collected the wise people of, or the noble people of the lands, and would haul them back to his capital of Babylon to increase his power and prestige. Are you having trouble seeing this slide in the back? Can you see it okay? Okay. So, that's how Daniel shows up in Babylon. And that's how the children of Israel get carried away into Babylonian captivity. Well, time passes. The Babylonian Empire goes through some upheavals. There's some of the kings only reigned a few years and then were murdered, and it got really tumultuous, and it lost some of its solidity. But there was another world power in the making. It was already getting started. Aaron, you can give us the next map. This world power, okay, Babylonia had been over here. So this is a much larger map now. This world power is centered around Persia. And what had happened was Persians and the Medes, who had been up in here, were distant relatives. And the Medes were the most powerful group. And they had basically kept the Persians kind of under their thumb. But they were still a related group, and many of the nobles were interrelated, intermarried. Well, these were both people that were whose cultures were heavily dependent on horses. So they rode a lot of horses. These were people who were out in the mountains and somewhat tribal and a little bit away from the centers of civilization and prosperity. But they were pretty vigorous and somewhat warlike. Well, for most of the history, they had been sort of subjected to either the Assyrians up here or Babylon, sorry, if I can say it correctly. Well, along comes a guy by the name of Cyrus. And this was Cyrus II. He came from a line of kings of Persia. He was of the tribe of Persia. And he said, it's enough of this. We don't want to be ruled by Media anymore. And so he staged a revolt. But when he defeated the Medes, he did something really unusual. And he basically just deposed the king, accepted the crown of Media, so he was the king of Media, but he was, more importantly, the king of Persia in his eyes. So he sort of lifted up the Persian tribe. We're great. But he did not go on this bunny trail, if you wish, of capturing all the people of Media and hauling them off to somewhere else and dispersing them. He didn't go there. And we don't know quite why he didn't, but it might have something to do with his religion. There's a little bit of uncertainty as to what religion he followed, but certainly his successors followed the religion of Zoroastrianism, which, when you first look at it, kind of reminds you a little bit of Judaism in some ways. It's monotheistic, and it's a good and a bad, but it stops about there somewhere. But it does leave a lot more of a benevolent feel. It's not as harsh as a lot of the religions of the Near East, especially the religion of Babylonia, where Marduk was, everybody had to worship Marduk or Bel or whatever god it was. So there was a little bit more leeway for other people to have different opinions and different religions. So Cyrus now has combined Media and Persia, and from there he goes on up to this time, an unprecedented military campaign. he subjects this entire region. First, he subjects what is modern-day Turkey over here. That's something that interests me. And along the way, there were some Greek-speaking peoples who had settled here on the coast. That's called Ionia. And he subjects that area very quickly. Lydia is where the a king by the name of Croesus, or King Midas, they're both the same guy. He's known as one of the wealthiest people in the world. And Cyrus conquers him in very short order. And as Cyrus's troops are sacking the city, there's this old story that says Cyrus was talking to Croesus and saying, and Croesus was watching the soldiers sack the city, and Cyrus is saying, you know, noting that his soldiers have conquered and they're sacking the city. And Croesus says, it's not my city, because Cyrus had just conquered it. It's Cyrus's city that his soldiers are sacking. And Cyrus immediately orders his soldiers to stop sacking it. Well, from there, after conquering that area, he moved south and went after Babylon. And that's where we pick up the story in Daniel again. So Daniel talks about Belshazzar, or maybe it's Belteshazzar. I think in the Bible he's called Belteshazzar, but I believe he shows up as Belshazzar in other places. talks about him being the last king of Babylon. After him, the kingdom was taken from him and given to Darius the Mede. Interesting. Yes? You know, I didn't read it recently enough that that's probably the case. I admit that I miss T's in there sometimes. Whatever the case is, in secular history, this guy shows up as Belshazzar. So I think it's probably the same from what you're saying. Well, what happens is Cyrus is moving against Babylon. The last king of Babylonia was actually not... Now, hear me out, was not Belshazzar. It was his father. But his father didn't really hang out in Babylon at all. He hadn't been there for years at the time it fell. His son, Belshazzar, ruled in his stead as a military commander and as kind of the regent of the area. So he was the de facto ruler of Babylonia, of Babylon. And most of the upper crust, or at least the priests of Babylon, did not like his father at all. Because his father was trying to elevate an ancient religious cult that was not what they followed. So you had two competing religions going on, and the the older religion that was that the king was trying to make greater was very much out of favor with the ruling, or with the kind of the nobles and the priests of the day. So they didn't really like him, and so he just basically stayed out of Babylon, hadn't visited the city for years, and his son ruled in his stead. Well, Cyrus comes against him with the help of the ruler, of the governor, what had been the governor of this Babylonian province of Assyria. Cyrus comes against him, and this guy defects to Cyrus's side. So now Cyrus has joined forces with this kind of this coalition of part Babylonian forces and part Cyrus's forces, and they come after Babylon. And when he conquers Babylon, according to one legend, he basically uses an ancient reservoir. See, the Babylonian walls were just too big to attack, but there was a river that flowed underneath them. And there had been an ancient reservoir made that where you could divert the river into this reservoir, this large basin. But it had then been blocked off so the river flowed normally. Well, Cyrus came along and said, oh, that's how we'll do it. So he dug a canal and channeled the river into this basin. So at the walls of Babylon, the river's water level dropped to the height of a man's thigh, roughly speaking. And this is a legend. We don't know for sure that this happened. And then they just walked in under the walls on through this river, and according to most sources, took it without much of a battle or without any fighting at all. And that was the end of Babylonia and of Belshazzar. Yes?
What was the name of the man who defected to Cyrus?
I was afraid somebody would ask me. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's G-O-Y, and then it's B-R-A-S or something like that. And I'm suspicious that he shows up in Daniel's account as Darius the Mede, is my suspicion. I don't know for sure. The names in Daniel don't line up necessarily with the names that you find in in Wikipedia or any encyclopedia that you might look in. And I don't think that's a really big issue, because it's common in the ancient historical accounts for one writer in his language to call a guy a name, and another writer in a different language to call the same guy by a different name. And so it's probably not that big of a deal if it's Darius or Cyrus or who it is. In most, what I think is probably the case is Darius the Mede was a governor of Cyrus. It clearly talks about Cyrus later on in Daniel. And so I suspect that's what's going on there. And that's how... That's some of the issues you deal with when you talk about primary sources like the Bible or Herodotus or any of those other historians, is there are some uncertainties as to how they interface. It doesn't really mean one is wrong and the other or right, but...
I'm sorry, I just... Where do you find the Medes up there?
Okay, they're not up here. I'm just pointing to an area. I didn't actually have a map that showed you. The Persians were down here around Persepolis, and the Medes would have been more over in here. So they were very close to each other geographically speaking. All right. I see I'm going to have to race the clock. I'm sorry. Well, so he conquers Babylonia, and then he says something. He says, he makes this proclamation. We actually have it on a clay cylinder that was found in Babylon, and we have it in the Bible. There's slightly different wording. The clay, and this is the proclamation that all people can just go back to where they were. They can worship in any way they please. So all of these captured peoples that had been dispersed in these last two empire periods were allowed to go back to their homelands, including the Jews. And that's what we know of as the end of the Jewish, the Babylonian captivity. But this cylinder that they found, and they actually have it in a museum somewhere, it talks about Cyrus being somehow connected to Marduk, the god of Babylonia. So there are some differences in the cylinder's account and the biblical account. But if you want to read more about Cyrus the Great, you can find several references in the Bible. I think one in Chronicles, maybe 2 Chronicles, and one in Isaiah. One place it calls Jesus, or God is talking to Cyrus and says, it calls him his shepherd. So, very interesting how God uses these pagan, or at least religiously different rulers, to accomplish his purposes. That's one of the things that I find very fascinating about history. Well, in 499, the ruler, so Cyrus's descendants then began to rule after him, and you can see on your timeline that the Persian Empire lasted a good little stretch. It lasted from about 550 to 330. During that time, there were many different rulers. That's during the Persian Empire that the Book of Esther took place. It was probably Esther's husband, or the king during Esther's time, that tried to conquer the Greeks during the last and greatest Persian. Pardon me. During the last and greatest Persian invasion of Greece. So what goes on over here in Greece? You have this hodgepodge of cities. They all speak Greek, and they have a very, in some ways, similar culture, but they don't get along. In fact, they fight a lot. So each city was basically a state to itself, a nation in itself. So you had Athens, and you had Sparta, and you had Corinth, and all these different city-states. There were more besides that. And they would just squabble all the time. But along came this enormous Persian Empire and tried to invade. And they immediately said, whoa, we're going to have to get together. We're going to have to stick together and fight off these guys, because we're talking the whole world is basically coming after us. And in their way of thinking, this was the wealthiest, most powerful, most culturally advanced part of the world that existed. And with the exception of perhaps China, that was true. This is nearly the belly button of the world, if you wish, culturally speaking. Kind of the center. Well, they got in this big fight with Greece, and these kings were like, look, there's no way these little city-states can stop us. We're going to take them whether they like it or not. And so they tried several times. The first time they were very successful in conquering the Greeks over here in Ionia. It didn't take long. But when they tried to invade mainland Greece, things got very different. And this is a classical period of history. So this is the time of the Battle of Marathon, the Battle of Thermopylae, the various sea battles. Several of these Persian Empire emperors had tried to invade and conquer and kept having little problems. Finally, Xerxes, or probably Xerxes, said, enough is enough. I'm going to get my whole army. I'm going to call people from every part of my empire, and I'm going to go stomp on those little Greeks because they're getting really troublesome. Well, he invades through the Bosphorus up here, which is just a little narrow channel of water you can easily see across. He built this bridge of boats to try to cross this thing, and a wind came up and smashed his bridge. Well, he got angry, and so he had his men thrash the waters with a whip and throw a pair of silver shackles in it and said, this punishment has been laid upon the bitter waters because of the way you acted, and you're trying to... So this is a guy who really thought he had the strings of power. He is the king of kings. That was a very common term for these Persian emperors. Well, he gets across there and heads down south. And along the way, he meets a delaying force of Spartans and various allies in the very famous Battle of Thermopylae. It was a narrow pass. They held them off for a long time. It was just a very small force against a very huge force. It was just kind of a classic battle of the tiny Greeks against the huge Persian Empire. Well, he went ahead and defeated them there after much bloodshed and too much time. He got past them, and he goes down, and the city of Athens gets out of town. They get in their boats and go to an island, and he conquers Athens and burns it, and he's making headway. And then he meets the Greek navy, and they just soundly defeat his forces. His ships are burned, and many of his men are killed. And eventually, his invasion just bogs down. He can't go any farther. And so he has to turn tail and go back home. And that was a terribly bitter pill. It was something he could just barely handle. Because here is this greatest king of all the world, and a tiny little section of the world won't let him come into it. Well, I think in Daniel, you're going to find some interesting stories about that. But what gets more interesting is when we move to the next guy. You can go ahead and give me the next map. This is Alexander the Great. You can barely see the outline here of his empire, but you can quickly see that it includes all of the Persian Empire, right? Well, Alexander the Great was from Macedonia, which was Greek-speaking over here. His father was Philip II. He conquered, he kind of subjected pieces of the Greek Empire. Of the Greek peninsula and the various city-states. He had subjected a couple of these city-states. And then he died, and Alexander gets a hold of the reins of power. And he goes to town. He is a young man. He's, I think, right around 20 years old when he becomes king. And he goes on this incredible campaign. Militarily speaking, he is one of just a handful of people who were never defeated in battle. We're talking a man who goes on a 12-year campaign. He only reigned for almost 13 years. But you can see that during his lifetime, he nearly subjected all of the world that mattered to the Greeks. Well, first thing he did was he spent some time here subjecting the Greeks, the other Greeks. So now he's got a united Greece behind him. He goes back across the water and invades Asia. And this has been the dream of Greek speakers ever since Xerxes had invaded their land. They're saying, we're going to come back after it. And that's exactly what happened. And he goes on this rampage through here. He comes down here and just completely defeats the Persian forces. Every time he meets them, he defeats them. He defeated them several times. There's such a huge empire. It took a number of battles to actually subject it. And he finally captures the last king of Persia. Or he actually doesn't capture him. The guy is murdered by his servant before he gets to him. But whatever the case is, he completely subjects what they knew as the known world. And he did this in 12 years, almost 13. And you can see on your timeline that Alexander the Great's lifetime is really, really short. Now, in Daniel, you'll read about, you'll read a description of the king of Greece. That's talking about Alexander the Great, I'm quite certain. And it's quite a fascinating description. Kind of, it describes his speed. His speed was outrageous. Well, Alexander the Great died probably of drinking too much. he was a party animal, and I think his short lifetime may have given us some clues as to how hard he partied. He did not leave a very well put together empire. It was an empire that he had just kind of gobbled up. And what he had left was an empire made of different peoples who spoke different languages. And the only thing that held them together was who had conquered them. Well, he didn't have an heir. He had a wife. His wife was pregnant at the time he died, but they didn't know if it was going to be a boy or a girl. And on his deathbed, he was asked, "Who do you leave your empire to?" And we're not quite sure what he said. It may have been to Craterus, who was one of his top generals, but just a slight change of the Greek may have, you might understand it to mean to the strongest. And that's what his generals decided he meant. And so they immediately went after his empire, tooth and nail. And these were men who had spent most of their lifetime fighting for him, and now they're fighting each other. And it got really, really messy. So the next period of time on your timeline, you'll see from 322 to 376. That is, you often hear it called the Wars of the Didashi, I think is how it's pronounced. It's just a Latin term for the successors of Alexander the Great. And they fought over his empire during this period of time. Now, you can give me the next slide. This is how Alexander's empire got split, right? I mean, during this warlike time, you had five different generals claiming pieces of it and ruling it. But that didn't last long. During this time, you had five, and then you can give me the next slide, Aaron. Sorry, this one's a little hard to see. It's in German, if you can read German. So it quickly turned into four. It told me down here, and I can't see or pronounce some of these names, but the different this green was a one of Alexander's generals, but this guy over here, I'm not quite sure. That was a really small and fairly unimportant kingdom, and I don't think it was actually related to Alexander's generals at all. So it was basically four: here, here. These guys had this sort of uneasy truce going back and forth. So if any one of them got too powerful, the other guys would line up and fight him. They'd all get together and pounce on the guy who was too powerful. And that's exactly what had happened in this area. So for a very short period of time, there were four different kingdoms. And then when the war period basically ended, you had primarily three different dynasties, Greek-speaking dynasties, ruling Alexander the Great's former empire. I have to speed up. I'll try not to talk too fast. But these, so when I show you a map showing you four different kingdoms, that isn't how it stabilized. It finally sort of stabilized with three different Hellenistic dynasties ruling most of that area. Well, what happened next is a bunch of this got gobbled up in the Parthian Empire. And that is a group, Parthians were a group of people who quickly conquered back many of these areas, leaving a fairly small area over here ruled by the Seleucids. I am not quite sure what it means in Daniel where it talks about a notable horn being broken off and four horns showing up. I don't know if it's talking about these four different kingdoms or not. It seems like it is, but the fact that there were actually only three for most of that period of time leaves me uncertain. So you can do with it as you please when you get to that part and figure out what these prophecies mean if you wish to, or leave them somewhat ambiguous. You can go ahead and give me the next map. Now you're seeing something you're probably a little more familiar with. This area over in here is largely being forgotten. It's been overrun by Parthians. It has not, since the time of Alexander the Great, this empire over here has gradually lost some of its cultural importance, because with Alexander's empire, he took the Grecian customs and culture and language and spread it all the way out into here and into here. And those, so that kind of shifted the cultural center to Greece. Now, Greece had a huge impact on the cultural center of Rome, had a huge cultural impact on Rome. So Romans' culture was very similar to Grecian culture. Greece is kind of the Western, the beginnings of Western civilization, if you wish. So there has been a slight cultural change. And now this area is also losing some of its, technological advantages, if you wish. And you have this European area becoming much more vigorous and culturally important and technologically important. Well, the Grecian empire was largely built by Alexander. Everybody after him just kind of took what he had left and didn't really, militarily speaking, didn't do a whole lot. But one thing I ought to say before we get to that part, the Maccabees, the time of the Maccabees in, on your map or on your timeline, I think it gives it as 166 to 63. That time was a time when the Seleucid Empire was trying to conquer parts of Palestine, and the Ptolemaic Empire was going back and forth. So you had two of dynasties founded by Alexander's generals fighting over Palestine. And it was during that time that the one Seleucid emperor, I think his name was Antiochus III, he was a Seleucid Empire emperor, and he actually made the daily sacrifice in the temple stop. And he actually had pigs sacrificed on the altar. Now think, if you're a Jew, how horrible that is. And it was under him that these Maccabees became terribly restless, and the father Matthias, he was a rural priest, and there was a Hellenized Jew, a Jew who had kind of bought into the Hellenistic culture, was going to offer a pig on the altar. And as the guy was stepping forward to do that, Matthias jumped on him and killed him and then ran into the wilderness with his many sons. And it was there that the guerrilla warfare of the Maccabees kind of lit the fires, and they fought tooth and nail and using small groups of men against a much more powerful enemy, and kept defeating them time after time. And occasionally they would get defeated, but then they'd claw back, and eventually they established this independent kingdom. Well, along comes Rome. Okay, you'll have to leave that section of history for just a bit, and we'll jump back in time quite a ways to 509. This is back during the Persian Empire, just after Cyrus the Great had died, not long before that. And you now have a tiny little city-state in the Italian peninsula of Rome. And they finally kind of gained their independence. And slowly, 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 over a long period of time, this republic conquers the various neighboring states. And by, by 275 BC, they had gained control of all of this peninsula. So you can see that they haven't moved much. And during this time, the Hellenistic dynasties are still ruling the most powerful, wealthiest parts of the world. But then Rome gets into a series of wars with Carthage, called the Punic Wars. And during that time, her military grows and her land area grows. And she emerges from that as the most powerful player in the Mediterranean world. Then she turns her eyes eastward, and slowly, 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 but inexorably, her legions conquer one of these Hellenistic dynasties after the other. Eventually, all three dynasties fall to Rome, and what doesn't fall to Rome is conquered by Parthia. So at the time of Jesus, the Roman Republic had ended, but the Roman Republic had begun. And so the rulers were no longer elected, now they were empires. The Roman Republic had ended, and the Roman Empire had begun. Did I say it just backwards?
And also, I would like to clarify, what does Hellenistic mean?
Thank you. I should have said that. Hellenistic means the culture of the Hellenes, which was what these people over here in Greece called themselves. So it was Greek culture, if you wish. So, finally, Rome gobbles up the last of Alexander's general's dynasties, and is now pretty much mistress of the entire Mediterranean. And so when magi appear at Jesus at the stable, what is actually being told there is that the priestly class of the Zoroastrians has come, a group of people from that class has come into the Roman Empire. And those were the Roman Empire's enemies. So Herod had serious misgivings when he heard that the Magi were here. Because the Magi had been the kingmakers of the Persian Empire for centuries. I have run out of time. are there a few quick questions yet? I thank you for the feedback you've given me. Now, what you do with this, I will leave that up to you. You will have to sort through and make sense of the book of Daniel as best you can, but at least you have a bit of an understanding of the narrative of the history. Even if it doesn't all make sense or completely line up with what we have in the Bible, I think you can make sense of it from there. Back to you.